It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, some parts of the country are known to be bigger artistic hubs than others. We'll take a look at a surprising survey that highlights America's creative divide and find out where Wisconsin fits in.
First, Governor Scott Walker introduced his proposed transportation budget yesterday. The budget outlines which projects will be given priority in the state and how those projects will be funded.
But in the eagerly anticipated proposal, some projects will need to be put on the back burner in order to move others along. And how the projects are being funded could cause some conflicts in the state legislature.
Joining us now to talk about the proposed transportation budget is Jason Stein. He's the Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jason, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, Governor Walker has said all along he doesn't want revenue increases, increased gas taxes, that sort of thing. Is that the case in this new proposal?
Right. He has telegraphed that for a very long time, and he's not backed down on it. So what that means is we're going to see delays in some major projects in the state so that there can be some money freed up to increase spending for local roads and maintenance.
Right. Let's talk about some of those projects, and that's part of what may be controversial even for some Republicans. What projects are being bumped down the road, if you will?
Right. So the north leg of the Marquette interchange in Milwaukee is being delayed a couple years, and the Marquette interchange we finished as a state, and then as well the north-south of I-94, that leg from Milwaukee to the Illinois border, is also getting further delayed, as well as Highway 18-151 on Madison's south side.
And compare and contrast, Republican Assembly leaders revealed their overall agenda for next year. That included transportation. Republicans in the Assembly don't necessarily agree with what the governor is proposing here.
Right. They're saying that, look, we have relied on borrowing and project delays for too long to get by in transportation, and that the time has come to find some source of new money, whether that would be, you know, increasing the gas tax or trying to convince Congress to let us put tolling in place on some highways. They want revenue increases to be at least part of the solution alongside what would likely be still some cuts or delays.
Now, this is not the first round in this back and forth between Republicans and the legislature and Governor Walker. Can you give a little background on the last big state budget and the fight that went into transportation funding there?
Sure. The governor started out by asking for a very large increase in borrowing, and to sort of keep that under control, he zeroed out almost all borrowing on other things in the state budget, like buildings, you know, college dormitories, things like that. And the legislature ultimately cut quite a bit of bonding out of the budget, saying, look, we have just allowed payments on debt to become a bigger and bigger part of the state's road fund, and it's just gotten to be too much.
Talking to Jason Stein from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at Governor Walker's transportation budget proposal. He released it yesterday in conferences, press meetings around the state. What are we hearing today from those Republican Assembly leaders? What are they saying about this proposal from the governor?
They're so unhappy with it. It has been remarkable the extent to which Republicans have been openly arguing among one another in the middle of an election. It's kind of like parents fighting in front of the kids is how I jokingly describe it. And I think that really goes back to a real deep-seated difference of view on how the state ought to move forward in terms of what is its biggest infrastructure investment.
And there are concerns, again, raised by some Republicans that deferring maintenance, deferring projects now may lead to more costly work down the road. Is that an argument we're hearing from them still today?
Sure. Sure. That's absolutely an argument. In some cases, they're saying, you know, the governor, the metaphor he uses is when you have a lot of projects that need done on your house, you focus on the ones that have to do with safety, and then you do them one at a time as you can. And the Assembly Republicans are saying, well, that's fine as a metaphor, but it's also true that if you think you have to tear down your house, having to do maintenance like replacing the roof or something like that doesn't necessarily make sense either. It might make sense to just go ahead and tear down the house right now if you know you're going to have to do it sooner or later. So, you know, that's sort of the two different ways of looking at this, and that's what's going to be argued really from now into June of 2017.
You mentioned that some money is being added for local governments to help them with their local road repair, and that's something that we've heard from people with local government organizations. That's something they say has been sorely needed. Is that a particularly controversial part of this plan?
No, I mean, I think that that's, you know, $65 million more over 2 years for local governments and their roads and bridges, and I think that's something that will probably stay in whatever proposal gets passed by lawmakers. But the argument here is, okay, you're going to get that extra money. How are you going to do it? You're going to get that money. And the governor's saying, well, we're going to prioritize and shift money away from or just not spend money on other major projects. We're going to just, you know, tend to the roads we already have. What Assembly Republicans counter is to say, that's fine to do a one-time cut in spending, but it's going to be difficult to make cuts in spending going forward every time we need, you know, more money for maintenance and that sort of thing.
Have Democrats in the legislature been speaking out on this, or have they been content to stay on the sidelines while Republicans argue amongst themselves?
Well, I mean, I think they have been. I think you'll see more of that from Democrats and Republicans both as they actually digest the plan. I mean, it's really been only today that we've seen, the bottom line details on this, and we have yet to see the entire transportation proposal. I got an advanced look at it yesterday, but no one has outside the administration has seen the whole thing. So, you know, we'll be hearing more about that. Obviously, though, the Democrats are in the minority, so there's not a big role that they've played in this or really any other debate to speak of in recent years.
Now, one possibility as the budget process moves forward is that the legislature does do something like increasing gas taxes, and then Governor Walker would have to decide whether to sign or veto it. Has he given any indication saying, if you guys send a gas tax increase to me, I will veto it?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's made that very clear. Yeah, I in the previous budget and in the current budget. Now, is it possible that there could be some modest increase in revenues for transportation and, you know, some decrease in other taxes or fees elsewhere in the budget? Yeah, he could certainly agree to that. We could also see Republicans shift sales or income tax money away from schools and healthcare to roads. That's another thing that they have done in the past, and they certainly could do again. But the chances that the governor allows a gas tax to go through unvetoed are zero.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Jason Stein. He's a Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about Governor Walker's new proposed transportation plan.
A recent study by the National Endowment for the Arts shows geographic differences in creativity. While most of us might think that engagement in the arts is focused along coastal cities, cities like Los Angeles and New York, the real breakdown runs along a north-south divide.
Wisconsin was one of the more creative states, with 70% of folks surveyed saying they attended visual or performing arts events or go to movies. 46% of Wisconsinites said they read literature, and 53% personally created or performed works of art. A whopping 66% consumed art via electronic media.
Ann Katz joins us now. She's the executive director of Arts Wisconsin. She's a board member and past president of the Wisconsin Public Radio Association. Ann, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
So in the grand scheme of things, why does it matter if a state is creative or not?
Well, I'm really glad that the NEA has been doing these surveys, and I'm really glad for the chance to talk about how creative Wisconsin is, because I have the privilege of traveling around the state on a regular basis, and I could go on and on about how incredibly creative the people of Wisconsin are. It's important in many, many ways. We are living in a creative age. We are our economy is transforming, being transformed by many forces, local and global, into an economy where creativity is a resource that we can measure, that we can invest in, that we should be investing in, and that everyone gets to participate in. We've gone through the manufacturing age, and that's still going to be a very important industry for Wisconsin. But more and more, we're living in an era where our economy is based on ideas, innovation, and entrepreneurship, and most of all, creativity. So the whole idea of creativity being something that everyone is part of, that we can base an economy on, and that we can measure and track and invest in, that's the 21st century right there.
And how does Wisconsin stack up in your eyes?
Well, as I said, I could give you a million stories of the ways in which Wisconsin is examining its creativity and figuring out what to do with its creative assets, people, businesses, organizations, and communities. So Wisconsin, as you said at the beginning, is above in terms of participation that you can measure. There are a higher percentage of people who go to events, whether it's a symphony in a large city or a small town, or a performance at the local art center or something in between. People actually go out to participate, and of course that's what our sense of community is all about. We're higher we still read books, which is good, and we very much create the arts. So that, I think, is the most important thing, that people have a chance to express themselves creatively, whether they call themselves artists or not. The idea that people still or very much go out and make things for their own enjoyment or to sell or whatever, I think that's a really important part of discovering our creativity.
This survey was particularly interesting because the assumption for a long time has been that culture is really driven from the coasts in. So you've got these major creative hubs like San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, and that maybe Wisconsin is more flyover country. Maybe it's not as creative as some of these other big hubs. But then if you look at this map that's been generated from the NEA survey, you see that really the line of the most creative states, it runs about halfway through the country. And the farther south you go, the less creative these states are. You go farther north, you start seeing states that are more creative. And in fact, Minnesota is even more creative than Wisconsin is. But looking at that geographic divide, why do you think that is?
Well, this is another way to smash that myth that somehow only people who live on the coast are creative. I mean, again, we could all talk about the ways in which that people are creative in Wisconsin, and this is what I get to do every day. I get to talk about that. I get to show it. I get to tell the stories. I get to help measure it, and I get to speak up for it. Wisconsin is has always been a progressive place. We are very rooted in our communities. I think the Wisconsin idea has a lot to do with the ways in which we get to express ourselves. And you know, we're a populist place, and so humans have been expressing themselves creatively since the beginning of time. And Wisconsin is a good example of how people on the local level express themselves creatively. Again, whether they call themselves artists or not, whether they are involved in professional arts activities, which many people are, or whether they do it for the love of it, I can attest, I'm here to testify that Wisconsin is incredibly creative, and we're working to make it even more so.
Now, in terms of the creativity hubs within the state of Wisconsin, Milwaukee gets a lot of attention. It's got a world-class art museum. Madison has a lot going on. Eau Claire has been really booming lately. But are there other parts of the state you think that we should zero in on and say, look, there are all these places in Wisconsin, some of them that we might overlook here within Wisconsin?
Well, every place in Wisconsin is creative. And again, I've been traveling around the state for a long time, and I could give you a million stories. I hate to, not that I hate to mention places because it's so wonderful to talk about places, but I know I'll miss some. If you look at what's happening in the North Woods now, there are new and renovated art centers in Minocqua, Land O'Lakes. There are two in Eagle River. There's one in Three Lakes, Rhinelander. There's an increasing number of artists and creative people who want to live in a small town. You can afford to buy a house. You can have a studio. You can send your kids to school. You can be in a community. People know the North Woods and want to spend more time there if they've been there for vacation. So the people that are living there are doing a lot with regional activities, focusing on cultural tourism, focusing on quality of life. It's not just the quote-unquote arts people, it's the local officials, it's the economic development professionals, the educators, the business leaders. That's just one part of the state. Door County has long been known for its creative endeavors. Central Wisconsin, Wausau, has been transforming itself through quality of life and downtown development. Stevens Point is working on cultural districts. As you said, Eau Claire has got the Confluence Project going on, which is a multi-million-dollar public-private partnership. Along the St. Croix and Mississippi Rivers, all those small towns, pretty much quality of life and creativity is what they're basing their economies on. That's just a small sampling. So I think that there is a huge amount of stuff going on in our bigger communities, Milwaukee, Madison, Appleton, Green Bay, et cetera, et cetera. And our smaller communities are exploring and benefiting from that creative spark as well.
We're talking with Ann Katz right now, Executive Director of Arts Wisconsin, and she's joining us now to talk about the geography of creativity in the United States. And it turns out the northern half, roughly the northern half of the country, is more creative, more people doing things like making film, making art, writing than in the southern half of the country. And the people who did this survey, the NEA, they pointed out that there is a relationship between education, personal finances, and creativity and artistic interests. So people who have education, the more education you have, the more likely you are to be involved in the arts, and the more money a community has or an individual family has, the more likely they are to send their children to high school, college, advanced degrees. And so how do we keep arts from becoming something that's elite, that's only for a select group of people?
Well, I think that the people in Wisconsin are doing their best and more to make sure that everyone gets access to the arts. There are programs, there are educational programs around the state, there are community-based efforts around the state that are all about everybody participating, and that's a huge thing. It's not just that people who have money or more education participate in the arts. Everybody is creative. A fundamental part of our message is that everyone deserves to be involved in the arts, and I think that there are lots of myths out there. There are lots of beliefs about the arts in one way being one way or another, but as I said, pretty much that creative spark, whether you call yourself an artist or not, it is out there in Wisconsin. And I think that people who are making the arts happen and being and participating in the arts on the local level, they don't have time for worrying about whether things are not for us or not for somebody else. I think they're just participating and they're doing it.
And along that same line, the survey said that kids who were not taken to art museums were less likely to grow up to be adults who attend art museums. So how can we, do you think, better engage children in the arts in Wisconsin, and particularly in underserved areas, maybe urban or rural areas?
Well, that is a huge concern, because as budgets get tighter and tighter on all levels, and I completely understand, we are all living the realities of the budgets on all levels. It is the case that the arts are cut out of edgy public school education disproportionately. And that's a concern. You know, if they cut the strings program out of my kid's school, as a middle-class person, I'm going to go and get my kid strings lessons, which is great for my kid. But as I keep saying, everybody deserves to participate in the arts, and every kid should have the arts in their education. So I think that people rising up and making sure that it's a priority, talking to school boards, talking to local elected officials about the importance of the arts for their kids. I have to give a shout-out to the many, many school districts and nonprofit organizations that are working in partnership to make sure that the arts happen. There are places like American Players Theater, which is a major arts institution in this state, and I should have said that Southwest Wisconsin is full of arts opportunities as well as every other part of the state. But, you know, the educational programs that they do, in addition to the high quality and world-class arts that they do, the kinds of educational programs that they do for the school, for school children in South Central and Southwestern Wisconsin, it's profound, and it's an important part of their mission. And so many other, every other organization I know that's out there making the arts happen has education as part of their mission. So school districts focusing on the arts, working with community partners, I mean, and the people rising up and making sure that that is a priority. I think we all have to speak up as advocates for our kids and for our communities to make sure that everybody gets to participate in the arts.
Ann, thank you so much for joining us today.
Nice to be here. Thanks so much.
That was Ann Katz. She is Executive Director of Arts Wisconsin, and she joined us there to talk about the geography of creativity in the United States, and more specifically, here in Wisconsin.
Our life expectancy has gotten a lot longer over the last century or so. As our next guest writes, a five-year-old in 1900 could look forward to another 55 years or so. That same five-year-old in the mid-1990s was looking at another 70-plus years.
And we're not just living longer, we're working longer, too. And that's leading to big changes in the workplace and in our personal lives. In their new book, our guests say we need to start dealing with these changes as individuals and as a society.
Rosalind Barnett is a senior scientist at the Women's Studies Research Center at Brandeis University, and Carol Rivers is professor of journalism at Boston University. They're the co-authors of the new book, The Age of Longevity, Reimagining Tomorrow for Our New Long Lives. Carol, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Rosalind, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, Carol, let's have you start us off with the basics. We're living longer, we're staying healthy later in life. Spell out how these changes are working.
Well, we actually have a new stage of life, which we call late adulthood, and that's roughly from 55 to 80 plus. And that was a time when, for example, the psychologist Eric Erskine said that at 65, your creative days are over and you have to sum up and face death. And what we now know is that sounds very archaic, that people who are in their 70s and 80s are, for example, running for president. Both our presidential candidates are in late adulthood. So we really have to start changing about the way we think of our lives, because we are, many of us, going to live to ages which were unthought of in the past.
And Rosalind, in the book and in pieces that have been in papers lately, you point out research that says these older workers are actually, in many ways, very good, effective, creative workers.
I know, it sounds surprising, because we our sort of cultural myth is that old workers are dotty and lazy and kind of just hang on. But in fact, they turn out to be very stable and productive. And part of the stability has to do with they have fewer ups and downs in their lives at that stage in life. They've been around the racetrack a couple of times. They're not unnerved and upended by crises. So their performance is consistent. Their cognitive skills stay fresh. So we have really very outdated ideas that we have to correct, because if we don't do that, a lot of people are going to be shortchanging themselves. If you don't have an expectation of what your life can be in your 70s and 80s, then you don't have anything to go for. So a lot of people give up and don't think that there's a future for them. But that's not the case, and our book is hopefully going to change all that.
And Carol,
it was stunning that a 2010 study found that younger workers were less stable and less consistent than the older workers. And people would have thought that it would be the reverse, but it wasn't. The older workers didn't panic if there was a problem. They knew they had many, many skills of how to get around problems and issues. They had a lot of things that the younger workers didn't offer, and that was a real stunner.
One thing that people might have reservations about is all the quickly changing technology. There's even a generation gap between, you know, millennials and Generation X on that. What did you find as you looked into this, Rosalind?
Well, for one thing, the fact that someone doesn't know a technology doesn't mean they can't learn it. So a lot of older people may not have had a need to learn some new piece of software, but that doesn't mean they can't learn it. So if you just judge someone's ability by what they're doing right now, you miss the boat. And we find that the people that we surveyed, older workers, are very savvy. They're online a lot. And they can be taught new things because they have an interest in learning them. So I think that we have to broaden our horizons a little bit and don't write people off. And it's also true that we now have a multi-generational workforce. In fact, there are four generations now in the workforce. And having age diversity is an important thing that will defeat ageist attitudes. And people can learn from one another. Younger workers can learn about the institutional memory that older workers have and about strategies for succeeding. And older workers can learn new software and new technological skills that they might not have had a chance to learn earlier on. So you have a very rich environment for people to break through myths and to form very meaningful generational relationships.
We're talking to Carol Rivers and Rosalind Barnett. They're the authors of the new book, The Age of Longevity. We're looking at the fact that we're living longer, working longer, what that means for our society. And let's zoom out a little bit, Carol, and look at what this all means. We've got this big, huge change, it sounds like, in who is showing up at work every day. Are we ready for it? Are we thinking about what that means for what a workplace looks like, for how our society is set up?
We're not, because there's so much ageism out there. And we are also thinking that there's a war, you know, that the greedy geezers are going to grab up all the resources. But what research finds is that it's really a phony war. It's like back in the days when we said when women moved into the workforce, you know, families were going to splinter, men were going to lose their jobs. And in fact, you know, as more women moved into the workforce, there were more jobs for men. And we're seeing the same thing as older workers move into the workforce, that correlates with more jobs for younger workers. And why? Probably because if you have more older workers that are on the job, you know, they're buying things, they're contributing to the economy. They're not just gobbling up resources, they're contributing. So it's a win-win for both young and old.
And Rosalind, this is sort of a virtue out of necessity, too, because as we've got a growing population of older people, the following generations, it sounds like, are smaller. We have fewer younger workers coming into the market, so we need to tap into the creativity and productivity of older workers.
That's exactly right, and I think forward-looking employers will understand that. So they really need to create a different kind of culture within their companies, a culture that's more open to having an age-diverse workforce. And another point that follows with what Carol was saying, that the typical picture we have of older workers does not include the fact that older workers are job creators, that there are many entrepreneurs that are older. We tend to think of entrepreneurs as young kids who are in their 20s and working in their garage and dreaming of some great new thing, when in fact many more entrepreneurs are older than younger, and so they are being productive, creative members of our workforce and bringing people into the workforce in a way that we didn't imagine before.
Now, one spillover change from this idea that, hey, we're planning for longer lives than we used to. You know, a pop culture staple might have been that person in their 30s who wasn't married yet, didn't know what their career was going to be. They're running late on everything. Now, with more time to work with, it sounds like you're saying, in a way, what's the rush? Take your time. You've got a lot of stages yet to go. Carol?
Well, it used to be that, you know, parents would say, what do you want to be when you grow up? What thing do you want to do? And now parents may ask, what two or three things do you want to do? Because typically, young people now may have two or three careers, and they may, say, at age 55, start on a completely new issue. We talked to a man who left a management job at 65 and decided to become a farmer. and is very successful at it. So we're going to see that the trajectory of people's lives is going to be different, more varied.
And Rosalind, what does that mean in terms of useful skills for younger people to have to prepare for that? Are we needing to think more about adaptability, resilience?
Well, that's probably a good question. I think people, guidance counselors and teachers and parents need to be thinking about this. Maybe an openness, that you don't have to be locked in to think, well, you know, you've made this choice and if you don't like it, tough, you know, you're stuck with it. That there's more flexibility and more opportunities now also for older people to go back to get education, to get retrained. Many new programs are being designed particularly for older people at low cost or no cost. So the idea that you don't have to just tough it out if you make a choice that doesn't seem to be working for you.
And Carol, you are not all optimistic about these changes. One thing you point out is that inequalities we see among people aged 0 to 65 don't magically disappear after what used to be the retirement age. Can you talk about how income disparities, racial disparities are part of this story?
Yeah, that's one of our big worries, is that we're going to have this new age. It's going to be wonderful for people who are affluent and educated and not poor, but an extremely different and sad fate for people who are poor, who are not well, who haven't gotten educated. And we've just seen recently that there's been a dropping in life expectancy for particularly for blue-collar workers. And so if we don't tackle the inequality issue, then we're going to have the same problems, you know, as we grow older, that we're now seeing and we're talking about in this election cycle in the workforce. This, you know, the 1% gets and the rest does not. And that, with all this good news, that's the real problem.
We're talking about aging, quality of life, and the changing American workforce as more of us live longer and work longer.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you or is someone in your family working well past the old retirement age? And are you planning to? Are you seeing more older workers at your workplace? And how are the various generations getting along there? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation about aging in America. Our guests say we're living longer, we're working longer, and we need to make some changes to reflect that new reality. Carol Rivers and Rosalind Barnett are with us. They're the authors of the new book, The Age of Longevity, Reimagining Tomorrow for Our New Long Lives.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you working past what used to be retirement age? If so, is it because you want to, you have to, or a little of both? Do you work in a multi-generational workplace? How do people from different age groups work together? And if you hire people, are you seeing more value or a different kind of value in older workers? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Jane is on the line in Racine. Jane, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because what I'm seeing is a tremendous problem with ageism. You see a lot of elders at, for example, Walmart, fast food places, who have a lot of skills, and nobody wants to hire them because they're either over 55, over 60. I have a very good friend who went for an interview, an IT job, and he had been looking, and every interview he went to, they disregarded him. And he went to a place in Madison. The job was a perfect fit, and they wouldn't hire him. So until employers start recognizing all the things that your guests are talking about, you know, we're going to have a lot of very, very poor, unhappy elders out there, people who need money, but they can't get a decent job because nobody will look at them.
Jane, thanks a lot for that call. And we've done segments on this show on the difficulties faced by older people in the job market, not getting, once the employer sees their age, maybe they don't want to take a chance on an older worker. Rosalind, what's it going to change, maybe legally and culturally, to change that?
Well, one thing is the idea that you don't want to hire older workers because they're costly. you know, health costs and it's going to go out of hand and the company is going to be in trouble. But the new data is suggesting that's not the case, that younger workers are not cheap workers. The younger workers have young families. Young families have children. They get sick. So the fact older workers are less expensive overall than younger workers. And that's the piece of information that would be very important to get to employers. They need to know that because that is a roadblock. It's a mistaken, I believe, but it's there. So it's education. It's some forward-thinking CEOs who will create a program within it for their company to combat these ideas, to bring speakers in, to have a change the culture at the workplace. That's where it has to happen because you're right. These attitudes are very subtle. Most people won't admit to them, but they're there, and it can be worked on. They can be addressed, and it needs to happen.
And Carol, I don't know if you go ahead.
I said when we need the media to stop treating people who do something wonderful at age 78, for example, as some kind of outlier, because we're seeing more and more and more people being creative and active, and yet it is just the ageism is so hard to dent because it's so deeply ingrained. We have to keep, you know, saying it over and over and over again. Look, things have changed. It's not your granddad's world.
And Carol, in the book, you point out some people, not even in the recent era, a lot of people historically who have created their great novel or music or you name it, well past age 40 or 50 or even 60.
Yes, we take a lot of people that are creating well into what was considered the retirement years. You look at Toni Morrison, for example, who's, I think, 85, has just written, you know, another brilliant novel. You have Ruth Bader Ginsburg in her 80s, who is, you know, one of the most outspoken and brilliant people on the court. And you see more and more and more of this. So the idea that creativity ends, you know, somewhere in the 40s, we're just seeing great many examples that that's just not true.
Let's go back to our callers. Ryan is on the line in Waukesha. Ryan, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you want to bring up, Ryan?
Well, I just wanted to make the point that as previous callers have about the difficulty of an older worker getting a job, but I've observed just the opposite, and that is getting rid of the older worker while they're still on the job. The unspoken, we want the younger person, and it's economic, and it's probably some cultural things in there too. But the pressure of older workers to leave when they're not really wanting to do that.
Ryan, thanks for that call. Yeah, we see this in the journalism industry often, Carol. If we can buy out that person older, making lots of money, and bring on a much younger person who we can pay a lot less, probably not just in journalism. Is this a common problem?
Yes, and I see, for example, in journalism, it's about the money, because I've seen really brilliant, experienced people being replaced by much younger journalists who, you know, don't know a lot in some cases and are much less sophisticated. And so I think overall the quality suffers, but it's really easy to do sort of the quick and dirty thing because it costs you less.
We're talking about the new book, The Age of Longevity. The authors Carol Rivers and Rosalind Barnett are with us. We're living longer. We're working longer. We have to change some things, they say. Before we go back to our callers, Rosalind, we mentioned discrepancies by income. Are there different standards applied to men and women as we age? I think you point toward the acting profession as one where there's definitely a difference. But how about the rest of the world, Rosalind?
Well, it depends on what level you're at. I think in general, women have had a harder time in a variety of occupations. At a certain level, though, you know, the stars are the stars. I mean, Toni Morrison is not going to have trouble getting her next novel published. But going down where most of us live, women have a harder time, and that's very true. Also, women tend to live longer than men. So money and how to afford a long retirement or a long period of years is a huge problem. In fact, some recent data show that people are more afraid of running out of money than they are afraid of death. And this is a big problem for women. For one thing, they tend to earn less in their working lives. They also tended to take out time to rear their children, and that's cost them in the workplace in terms of seniority. So they end up with less money for retirement and very many expenses it's all a new phenomenon now, is that the grandparents are largely responsible for the education and welfare of their grandchildren. And why is that? Because the adult children, many of them have suffered greatly during the Great Recession. They lost their jobs, many lost their homes, they're in debt. So the grandparents often pick up the burden of the rearing the grandchildren, which adds to the other concerns that older women have. They have to support themselves and take care of themselves, but they also have this other burden they didn't have before. So I think that the women face a steeper road to climb.
Let's go back to our callers with Chris on the line in Wisconsin Dells. Chris, hi.
Good afternoon. My almost 94-year-old father was a stonemason, and a really good one. He used to split his own fieldstone, build houses from the ground up, which is a creative profession in itself. But he retired, and he was bored. And so he started making these little birch reindeer Christmas decorations out of birch wood, and they're kind of hulky, but they're fun. And he does that for fun. He's working with wood, which is always a good thing. And I wanted to, he fired three artists, unfortunately. All of his children are art people. We're all underemployed. And I want to put a plug in for people going to the theater, go to the ballet, go buy some paintings for people for Christmas, or calendars that are hand-painted or something, because we are all living on the verge of society. Anyway, that's...
Chris, thanks a lot for that call. Plug for Wisconsin's creative economy there. But also, she brings up a point, Rosalind, that you talk about in the book. Some people are working after normal retirement age because they have to. Some because they want to. They find fulfillment, often a little of both. Can you talk about that side of it, though, the not wanting to just be a retiree, wanting to keep doing stuff?
Well, in our culture, work is a major part of one's identity. What do you do? It becomes really important. It's a question people, and they ask the question, how are you, or what's going on? They're really talking about your work life. So if you don't have a work identity anymore, then you're really kind of loose ends, needing structure, because maybe other cultures wouldn't be so much like this, but our culture is. So the absence of having colleagues, a social environment, a place to go to, goals and so forth, really hits hard. And we have a lot of years to think about filling that way. You know, it's one thing if you were 65 and you expect to live a few more years. It's another thing when you're 65 and you may live 20 more years or 25 more years. That's a long period of time. And a lot of people are searching. And I think one of the things that's coming up are these institutes for older learners. Most universities now have them. And the tuition often is either free or very low cost. So I think seniors want to have something to be engaged with, to connect with each other around something other than sitting around and gossiping. So there are things that are happening, not enough, and many people don't know about them, but certainly it's a challenge for society going forward.
We'll leave it there. Rosalind, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much for giving us the opportunity.
And Carol, thanks to you as well.
I'm delighted. Thank you.
We've been talking to Rosalind Barnett and Carol Rivers. Their new book is called The Age of Longevity, Reimagining Tomorrow for Our New Long Lives, looking at the way our longer lifespans, our longer work spans are changing our lives and our society, our economy as a whole. You can still share your experiences. If you are one of these people who's staying in the workforce longer, we'd love to see your story. You can share it over at the Central Time Facebook page. Are you working longer? Why? Because you have to, because you want to, or a little bit of both. Also, while you're there, we've got a link to an excerpt from their book. Again, that's all at the Central Time Facebook page.
A Wisconsin tradition, Green County Cheese Days, kicks off tomorrow in Monroe, inspiring lots of cheese talk, including a conversation tomorrow morning after 6 on The Joy Cardine Show.
And WPR producer Chris Molina spotted this on Twitter. We're not sure how it got started, but there's a trending hashtag, cheesebooks. Hashtag cheesebooks. It's all cheese-related puns based on famous book titles.
Okay, hang on. Got to brace yourself
brace
for
yourself,
some of
yeah.
these. the pelican brie.
That was one of my favorites. And as we'll find, brie is a really easy one. There's also the unbearable lightness of brieing.
And the curious queso of Benjamin Button.
Some international cheese there. Waiting for Gouda. Like
I
waiting
like that
for
one.
Goudel. Little, you have to pronounce a little weird, but it
Rosemary's
works.
Rosemary's Baby Bell.
Baby Bell? What kind of, what is that? I know that exists.
My kids really like it. It's these little tiny rounds wrapped in red wax.
Okay, the old man and the brie. More brie there. Snow falling on cheddars is one of the best.
Gone with the rind.
Yeah. Swiss Family Robinson has its own cheese built in.
Riders of the Purple Sage Derby. That one I don't get.
So the book is Riders of the Purple Sage, and there's a sage called, I think, a Sage Derby. A Goudamand is hard to find.
Do we say On Stilton I Rise? No, I like that one.
That's a good one, too. Well, again, you can find all of those horrific cheese literary puns, if you will. The hashtag is Cheesebooks. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.